In 2020, Advocacy for Inclusion had the opportunity to interview some great guests in our Staying Connected podcast series. We started our interviews with the Canberra-based psychologist Paul North. Among many rich insights about maintaining mental health during the time of social isolation in the early part of the year, Paul offered the following advice about how to respond to the experience of feeling overwhelmed.
So the first thing is to actually have some compassion for yourself by realizing this is completely normal. No one's a superhero. See, if you actually, and what is compassion? And what is even self-compassion? Well, let's imagine that you sat down with your friend and your friend said to you, you know, like, this is really weird. I'm really stressed. I'm really worried about what's happening. And you said to that person, I get it. I am too. It's really scary. In that moment, that friend that you were sitting down with would feel validated and understood. That feeling is compassion. And what's really important is that we actually have some self-compassion. We have those same feelings we have for that friend of ours, we have them for ourselves. Kristen Neff, who's regarded as one of the leaders in self-compassion, she had her epiphany on a plane, traveling between the States and Britain. And she was traveling with her little boy, I think he was about 2.5. And in the middle of the flight, this little boy had a big tantrum. He'd completely lost it. Now, Kristen was at an interesting stage in her life. She'd just finished a PhD, but she lost her job. She just got divorced, and she was traveling with this little boy, and now he was losing it in the mid-Atlantic. And then, of course, all the meerkats, all the heads pop up, starting to judge her. She was feeling really terrible. And she thought, oh, well, maybe if I go down to the bathroom, you know, we can sort of close ourselves in there and I can settle him down. And she went down there. Of course, they were all occupied. So now she's out in the open and even more people are judging. You know, just give him a smack, love, like settle him down. And she put her hand on her heart and she said, Kristen, darling, this is really, really hard. You've been going through a lot. But you know what? You're doing your best and I love you. And in that moment, she had this epiphany, this welling up of self-compassion for herself. And that actually spurred her on to get into her work. And now she's world famous for it. This is a scary situation. It's completely foreign. So the very first thing is when stuff wells up in us, understand that that's natural. Your neurophysiology is just trying to keep you safe. In the process of that, fear will arise. It will also pass. It has to. It's all these emotions that we experience. They come and they go. Just a law of living on this planet. So we basically let it arise. We catch it. And we check in on it because the fears, by and large, in general, are about things that are happening in the future, in a future that hasn't even happened yet. We don't know. I don't really know if it's going to happen. People might think, oh, I'm going to lose my house. Hasn't happened yet. Right now I'm sitting in my house. I've got food in my belly. The temperature's okay. It's not snowing. I'm okay. So this is a journey of understanding that it will arise, it will go. If we can catch it, check in with ourselves, how am I right now? Then the fear will quite rapidly dissipate. So that's what this is a process. And we're going to fail at it. We're going to actually have moments where we are overwhelmed and we lose our temper. Yeah. Start again. Treat this as also an opportunity to practice these skills at just getting better at catching the fear quickly, not cooperating with it, coming back to the present moment, have some compassion for doing your best. Start again.
As the COVID-19 lockdown continued in the early part of the year, we noticed rising concern about increased domestic violence that would flourish in the isolation, My colleague Carla interviewed Sonia De Meza in her former role as CEO of the Domestic Violence Crisis Service, and Sonia offered this insight about the compounded disadvantage experienced by people with disability during this time.
As you know, we focus on people with a disability and advocating for people with a disability. What do we know about the experience of domestic violence for people with a disability compared to other sections of the community?
I think when a person has a disability, it can really exacerbate or compound their particular vulnerabilities when they're trying to deal or work through a family domestic violence situation. If it's a physical disability, it can make it even more problematic for that person to get away from the violence, so they become even more vulnerable. There could be disabilities that impact on a person's ability to verbally communicate what they're going through, and that can really make it even more difficult to get the supports that they might need. So there's some of the issues that people with disability might be facing.
Often in these situations, people may rely on someone else in their household to communicate for them. Is there any assistance that can be given to people that may be in a situation where they're relying on someone else to communicate for them to get out of a potentially dangerous situation?
Well, I think it's really important to ensure in this COVID-19 situation, we have a lot of isolation from each other to stay safe from the virus, and that can really create dangers in and of itself. So it's really important to stay connected with people, even if it's like on the telephone or via the internet. So those communications need to be there. And if someone has a care worker, for example, who comes into a house to support a person with disability, and if there's an opportunity, reaching out perhaps to that support worker and telling them what their concerns are and asking them for help so that they can get in contact with an organisation such as ourselves who can assist.
While a great amount of our attention was on the impact of COVID-19 on people with disability, we also focused on the ongoing work of the Disability Royal Commission. My colleague Rosalyn, AFI's Disability Royal Commission advocate, talked about her role and the importance of people with disability sharing their story with the Royal Commission.
So the Royal Commission is interested in hearing about people's experiences in any situation that they have been mistreated, abused, neglected, or exploited. It could have happened recently, or it could have happened a long time ago. Really, there's no limit to time or place. So they're interested in hearing about. They want to hear from anybody with disability who has been mistreated in any of the ways that I just spoke about. The more stories the Royal Commission has about examples of violence, abuse, neglect or exploitation, and where these things might happen, the more chance we have of stopping it happening to other people. So hopefully this will make our community safer and fairer for all people with disability.
We had the opportunity not long after speaking with Rosalyn to interview Kate Eastman, the Senior Counsel for the Disability Royal Commission, and we were able to find out from her how the Royal Commission was operating during the challenges of the pandemic, and also hear about the motivations of people who were stepping forward to tell their stories of violence, abuse, and neglect to the Royal Commission.
Can you tell me what motivations that people identified as that's caused them to actually take that brave step and share quite often terrible experiences that they've gone through?
Well, I've had three public hearings where people have come to give evidence and share their experiences to the Royal Commission. So we had a four-day hearing in Townsville on the topic of education with the focus on Queensland. And then we moved to Melbourne and we had a five-day hearing in December where we looked at the experience of living in a group home. And our most recent hearing was a longer hearing, a 9-day hearing that we had out at Homebush in New South Wales, looking at the health system for people with cognitive disability. And we have had many witnesses with disability come to the Royal Commission and share their experience. And their motivations, I think, will depend on each person as to why they wanted to do that. In some cases, we had family members whose children had passed away and their child had a disability, and they wanted to tell the Royal Commission what their personal experience had been so that others could learn from that experience, and their wish was that it never happened to anybody else. And so they were prepared to come and talk about some of the most personal, intimate experiences in their life and talk about a period of profound grief and distress in their lives, so that sharing their story would help other people. We had a number of people in our health hearing recently with disability to come and say, this is what it's like when I go to the hospital. And maybe if you hear my story in the Royal Commission, next time as a health professional, you might look at me differently. And you might see me as the person and not talk to my mum, but talk to me, and I can make decisions about my health. So the motivations were sort of varied, but I was overwhelmed by how courageous the witnesses were to come and to be able to share their personal experiences in a public forum, knowing that they were going to tell people things that they might not have ever told other people before coming to the Royal Commission. So their motivations were wide and varied, but I think that some of the witnesses who gave evidence really excelled their own expectations of what it was going to be like to give and share those experiences.
Advocacy for Inclusion's policy manager, Bonnie, came on the podcast on a couple of occasions to provide the big picture systemic view of what was going on for people with disability during 2020. In her first visit, she shared insights that were gained through an Advocacy for Inclusion survey that went out during the intense period of the pandemic.
What does the survey tell us about the main changes that people with disability have experienced since COVID-19 reared its ugly head and started causing us to be isolated and stuck in our homes? What's the story for people with disability in terms of what they've registered as different and challenging?
Yeah, so some of the really, really interesting and notable results told us that a lot of people were missing their community. A lot of people felt that their independence was very different. They couldn't go places that they would like to go. And one of the most interesting and most notable things was loneliness. So there's been a lot of research lately around the effects of loneliness in the community for people with disability and also the aged care community. And it really does highlight for our community the effect of loneliness when things just shut down. So those were just two of the biggest results that we saw that were really, really noticeable.
And I guess it's kind of a bit of a cumulative thing that we've got people with disability who may already be isolated, and then it's kind of, it's a double effect, but there's already that isolation, and then COVID-19 comes along and whatever social contacts they have are diminished.
So, I mean, the survey showed us that there was quite what was potentially a snowball effect for some people who may have already been lonely, and having their services kind of removed, but also non-accessible as well, kind of increase that loneliness. But also when you can't go out to your normal groups, you can't go out with your normal friendships, or even to school classes, or even into town, stuff like that has a detrimental effect on loneliness as well, especially if that's your everyday routine.
Children and Young People with Disability, CYPDA, brought out two key COVID-19 related reports in 2020. The first report, More Than Isolated, gave us a snapshot of the early days of the pandemic in the homes of children and young people with disability. The second report, Not Even Remotely Fair, took a specific look at the educational impact of the pandemic and the response on children and young people with disability. We had the good fortune of having CYPDA's CEO, Mary Sayer, on to discuss both reports.
We certainly did a very effective job of, I think the language in the report is that it provides a really comprehensive snapshot of a moment, which it certainly does. I think 64% of the responses came in that first week, I think, the 16th to 22nd of March. And for people who might have a short memory, this is, of course, the time of the great toilet paper crisis. So we had our supermarkets were being emptied out. People were panic buying. It really was a very chaotic time. And we have this survey. So based on the survey, what was that particular time, those early days of the pandemic, what was that like for young people with disability and their families?
Yeah, look, in the early days, there was much fear because families were really struggling to buy essential equipment and resources for their children and young people. So for some of us, toilet paper might be a big deal, but we're not getting it. But if you've got immunocompromised children and you need hand sanitizers or continence pads or a whole range of different nutritional supplies that all of a sudden you can't get, then of course it's an inconvenience for most people, but for children and young people with disability and their health and wellbeing, this can be really critical. The other snapshot that was happening at the same time was that services and supports quickly withdrew. So families reported that they were having cancellation of their NDIS supports for their children, as well as the whole confusion about moving to remote learning and school shutting. So in those first weeks, it was complete confusion. And you know, this is not to blame anyone because the whole of the country was in a bit of turmoil. But what it did show is that children and young people with disability face challenges in their everyday life in gaining equal access to services, supports. But what the COVID situation did was exacerbate that inequality that they already faced. So, you know, there were many families who were really left without essential services that their children need for their development and for their wellbeing. So it showed us that there was a lack of proper pandemic or emergency planning. And we know that in emergencies, people with disability generally are impacted harder and impacted for longer. So given what we've known about, you know, we're a country that has a lot of emergencies. Let's not shy away from that. So we should have expected that children and young people with disability would be disproportionately impacted. But we couldn't see that there was that planning in place. So it was really critical that we got this data out to our stakeholders. So when we were collecting this data, we were analysing it as we went. So weekly we were providing the information back to the NDIA so that then they could refine the FAQs that they were, or frequently asked questions that they were providing to NDIS participants. So it was really data we were collecting to inform policy response. And then at the end, obviously, we've been able to write it up as a report. But the most important thing is that we can provide that information back to our funders and stakeholders so that they knew what to do and how to respond.
Before the ACT election, we had the ACT Disability Minister, Susan Orr, as a guest. She came to outline the local government's response to the pandemic in meeting the needs of people with disability in the ACT region.
Obviously, there's a lot of communication that's been happening with individuals with disability as well as the community sector. And I know that when it comes to kind of rolling out support whether it's direct support or whether it's financial support, government very understandably uses what's available. So whether it's the community sector organisations or the NDIA, the National Disability Insurance Agency. But we know there are a number of people with disability in our community who aren't connected. So they don't have an NDIS package. There are people out in our community who have undiagnosed mental health conditions, people living rough on the streets, people with experiences of trauma who just simply don't want to have anything to do with anybody who looks official. How have we been able to connect with those people, particularly in the experience that they're having at this time?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because I think it's fair to say that as we've moved through the pandemic, people who wouldn't necessarily always consider themselves to be people who need that support are seeking out that support. And in a lot of the areas you've already said, particularly where mental health is a key critical issue. So what we've done as a government is we did have a community support package that we put out for the crisis response to the pandemic in the very early days, and that went to providing a lot more support for mental health organisations, because they were seeing an increase in demand for their services. It went to doing a lot more work with homelessness and housing providers, so making sure that people who were sleeping rough, that we had enough people to support outreach to them, so that we could go to people who were sleeping rough and have a bit of a chat. We've put a lot of funding into domestic and family violence services, because we have seen, unfortunately, in other countries that went into isolation, that there has been an increase in the need for support for people because of domestic and family violence. We've put in the Canberra Relief Network, the CRN as we call it, which is a really good initiative, a collaborative initiative for lots of community partners to come together to provide food relief to Canberrans. And this was a particular one that we did because we were seeing very early on that it wasn't necessarily easy to get toilet paper or other other food supplies from the supermarket. But we're also finding that it was quite difficult for our community sector partners to actually get a supply of food to provide to people who needed it. We also had a lot of people who were starting to say, I've never needed help getting food before, but now I do. And that could be for a range of reasons, all associated with COVID. So it could have been a case of someone who was living with a disability who didn't feel comfortable going out to the supermarket because you would come into contact with so many more people and they didn't want to take that risk. We also heard that from a lot of elderly people as well, that they just wanted to be very cautious and didn't want to be going out in large crowds. But we wanted to make sure that everyone still got fed because it's absolutely vital for us. So we put together the CRN, and anyone can call up. And if they're being impacted by COVID and they're not being able to get their groceries, then we can help them with that. So there's the provision there to make sure that we're getting those basics out to people. So we've looked at those in the crisis response, those initiatives, and we'll continue to look at those and monitor how the demand for services is going. And the other part too that's been really critical to this is sending out that message there that the government wants to support you, the community wants to support you. And I think that's been one of the really encouraging things around this, is the level of people who've got out and said, actually, no, we want to help out. And you know, you've seen these local groups pop up saying, we'll drop a flyer in a letterbox, and if you need help with something, let us know. And there's a lot of really goodwill there, which I think, I probably see it in other places, but I think pretty special to Canberra and a sign of how strong our community is. And we've really wanted to, as a government, reinforce that we are here to support everyone, and the community is here to support you, and that there's nothing wrong in asking for a bit of support if you do need it.
Emma Campbell, the CEO of the ACT Council of Social Services, joined us to discuss the social and financial impact that the pandemic was having on our local community.
I know that in the early days, when COVID first hit Australia, we saw the federal government started to roll out welfare packages to assist people, especially people in unemployment. I want to really drill down, and I know ACCOS is an organisation, I suspect, with a lot of policy boffins, people who are very good at the details of policy. So I want to focus on the $550 temporary increase to New Start. And I suspect it probably tells us a story as well. So with that $550 increase per fortnight for people on the New Start allowance, what difference has that made in terms of the quality of their life and they're accessing services, what difference does that money make?
So I think you're right about the increased telling a story, and the story that it tells us was that the rate of new start, now job seeker, was insufficient prior to the increase being announced by the federal government. So we saw prior to the increase, when people were having to survive on $40 a day, tremendous struggles around paying rent, electricity bills, and even putting food on the table. And so this extra, the $550 temporary increase, made a massive difference to people. They could pay their bills. They could go to the doctor. They could start paying off some of their debts and thinking about investing in some training to help them get into a new job when opportunities came around. So it was such an important decision by the federal government, and that's why we have an ongoing campaign with our partners, ACOS, the Australian Council of Social Service, to raise the rate permanently. But already we've seen concerning moves by the federal government, who from September will halve that temporary increase, which will impact many people who may face quite long-term unemployment. There are 13 job seekers for every job in Australia at the moment. In the ACT, there are 4 job seekers for every job. And we want to make sure that people who are looking for work are kept healthy, are kept well, can look after their kids, put food on their table, ready for when that job opportunity comes around. We know that countries that have decent levels of welfare actually have much better results in terms of getting people back into work, because people are able to reskill, feel well, not develop mental health illnesses or physical challenges because they're able to look after themselves. And there's no reason why Australia can't provide that same decent safety net.
Our final interview for the year was with Advocacy for Inclusion's CEO, Nick Lawler. Nick shared insights about the significant role of advocates working with people with disability, and also highlighted that we're in a time where we need more advocates to meet the needs of people with disability.
Do you think the demand or the need for advocacy at the moment, does that illustrate the fact that governments at all levels need to really be funding an increase in advocacy services, in the availability of advocates? Do we actually need to see that the workforce of advocates grow to meet the demand?
Absolutely, yes. And that's certainly been discussed quite significantly throughout the sector. And conversations have been taking place with, you know, funding providers to be able to boost support to the organisation, to be able, which will then obviously flow into the community. It is certainly something that is significant and needs to happen on an urgent basis.
When it comes to the advocates and the work they're doing, quite often they're a hardworking team, and quite often they need to go above and beyond sometimes the role of being an advocate in response to the needs of people and in answering shortfalls that people are faced with in terms of support. What does that need to go above and beyond tell us about the lack of support that's there for people with disability in terms of the broader disability sector?
It's a good question. And I think, the relationship between an advocate and a client is quite a unique relationship. And I don't think that COVID is unique, in serving or demonstrating advocates going above and beyond. And it always strikes me, and I find it incredible, the relationship that is formed between an advocate and the client in you know, their quest for a, you know, for an outcome suitable for the client. It, but yes, COVID certainly has brought on more of the going above and beyond, and I think that it, that really does come back to the strength of the sector, the advocacy sector. You know, being able to act and to respond appropriately to all types of advocacy models, you know, whether that be guardianship to, you know, assisting a person with their plan with the NDIS to get those necessary supports, to assisting someone in the AAT or the court system, child protection system. And, you know, so there's another probably feat in its way, the amount of knowledge and the breadth, the significant assistance that is provided out of advocacy services does sort of demand that above and beyond. And, you know, behind the scenes, we see research taking place and we see, you know, that knowledge gaining and seeking time spent to be able to assist our clients. It's above and beyond. So, yes, I hope that answers your question adequately, because it is certainly a significant part of what we do.